Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from 970 ESPN and Steelers Nation Radio, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves chilling, talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. Season 7, episode 124. I'm Dave Bryan from SteelersDepot.com. And sitting in once again for my co-host David Todd on this Friday is Alex Cazora. Alex, happy dead part of the season, slap in the middle of it. happy Friday to you as well.
Happy Friday, Dave. Yeah, it is dead as dead can be. So thank you, Steelers Nation, for sticking with us as camp's only a couple weeks away.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I teased you with this right before we got on the show, and it befuddled you a little bit more than I thought it would, so I'm going to get after you right away here. Who were the Steelers' starting running backs the last time the Steelers won a Super Bowl?
First name came to mind was Gary Russell, because I remember him returning kickoffs. I couldn't remember if that was the year Mendenhall got hurt or what his situation was, and I said Parker, too. He was the guy.
Willie Parker did start that game against the Arizona Cardinals. Gary Russell dressed for that game as well, too. You want to take a shot at another running back that dressed for that game?
Well, Mendenhall didn't, I guess. Who was it?
Davis.
Kerry Davis. Yeah, a little trick question there. A little more fullback.
Yeah, you're a little bit more of a fullback there. Do you remember who the starting tight ends are? Or do you remember what they opened with formation wise in that Super Bowl XL?
I feel like you watched this yesterday, so you have an advantage here. Well, Heath Miller, I'm guessing there was another tight end there. Was Matt Spaeth with the Steelers? Was he in Chicago at that time? Matt Spaeth?
Yeah, Matt Spaeth was there. It's kind of a trick yeah. question there because Sean McHugh.
Oh, good old 49, Sean McHugh. Wow, here's a name.
Yeah, it just goes to Sean. And let me tell you why I wanted to kind of open asking you about kind of the running backs there and the last time the Steelers won a Super Bowl. You get into this whole, you know, it kind of parlays back into the thing with Le'Veon Bell. Look, we're a little more than a week away from the deadline with Le'Veon Bell, and you know it's really ramping up now. Talking about will the Steelers extend him? Won't they extend him? What's his value? Are running backs still overvalued, extremely overvalued for the most part, fungibility wise and all? And where is the line? I'm not sure exactly where I want to go with this, but you know, kind of where is the line of a okay back and we can get away with a committee to we need this guy on the field, we got to have him type of player, which really, you know, when you look at Le'Veon Bell, I mean, let's face it, Rashard Mendenhall wasn't that guy, that all around player. He caught a lot of footballs during his time at Pittsburgh, and for the most part, Willie Parker was fast, right? I mean, do we really remember Willie Parker as being that uber all around, running back?
No, of course not.
So where do you draw the line at fungibility and man, this guy is just more than just a running back.
Well, it's hard to quantify that and put an actual, description to it. I think you know it when you see it. And in this case, you know it when you watch Le'Veon Bell play. And, you see a guy that is more than just a running back. To kind of diverge slightly, but to get back to your point, Dave, we've had a lot of debates, or at least I have on Twitter, about who's the better running back, Zeke Elliott or Le'Veon Bell. And, I've made the point that I think Zeke's, as a pure runner, is a slightly better running back than Le'Veon Bell. But when you look at everything that a running back is asked to do, whether that's pass protection, catching out of the backfield, and volume of snaps played, Bell wins in a landslide and is a better running back overall. So, Bell is, skill set is so unique that I don't think there might be one other guy in the league that can do what he does, David Johnson. And I think that just takes it to a whole new level that, you know, may obviously makes him different than Willie Parker or any kind of committee or one-note running back.
Yeah, look, I mean, make no mistake, Le'Veon Bell, I don't know if you saw it on Thursday, I posted, looking back at Le'Veon Bell's first 4 years in the league and comparing it to other great running backs in their first 4 years in the league. Now, obviously, Le'Veon Bell doesn't have the amount of games played, or really, for that matter, the amount of total kind of rushes, if you will. In fact, I think he's way down on the list. I mean, he does have more than a few of these guys on the list, but not many. But, only 47 games played in his first four seasons, whereas a lot of these other running backs were playing 60, 61, 62, 63, 64 games, somewhere along in there. But when you look at his overall, total touches and his yards from scrimmage, he's got over 6,000 total yards from scrimmage during the regular season. And you look at his yards per game average and his yards per touch average, and you think, oh my! I mean, this guy really produces when he's on the field. For those that missed that post, 128.72 yards per game average. Now that's an average. 5.33 yards per touch. His yards per game average is tops of of everybody, really. When it comes to running backs in their first 4 years in the league, and that's quite astonishing when you think about it. So there is a line of fungibility wherever it is when it comes to running back. And then I think it's obvious that Le'Veon Bell is on the other side of that line. And one other thing to kind of talk about, and in fact I had wrote about this just before Pro Football Focused posted this on Twitter the other day. I included this stat in the breakdown that I did on Le'Veon Bell, was the fact that he was the when it comes to running backs last year, he had the lowest percentage of lost yardage tackles last year, or lost yardage carries, I should say. And that number was right at, 5%. And the next closest was Frank Gore at 5.3 and Mark Ingram at 6.8%. It means a lot in the NFL. Obviously you like to have a back, rush and gain 4 or 5 yards every carry. But how much does it mean to a team when a back carries a football and at least doesn't lose yardage?
Oh, it's huge, and it's one of the underrated aspects with Le'Veon Bell, and that goes back to his patience of being able to wait for the hole to open and not, run maybe necessarily to where the play is supposed to go, but he's able to create, and he's turned a lot of potential, negative plays into positive ones. I think there was one against Baltimore last year that was just, insane, and there's so many we could reference. But, it's a big difference, Dave, between, second and 12 and second and 8. And Bell's able to put this team in, at least second and 8 so many times when it should be second and 10, second and 12. So, man, that's huge. And that's one of the things that I think, again, separates Bell from the best backs in the league.
Going back to 2008, how old were you in 2008?
What was I, 15? young Alex, young whippersnapper.
You couldn't even drive the McLumina then, could you?
I don't want to drive it now. So 15-year-old Alex has the upper hand, I think.
There you go. Do you remember what the Steelers' average yards per carry, or roughly what their average yards per carry was during that 2008 season?
Man, are you Alex Trebek today? I feel like I got to play the Daily Double here. It probably wasn't great. The running attack wasn't the best. The line was bad. I'll say 4.0.
No, it was higher. It was higher than that. Believe it or not, and this is off of the media side of the NFL side of things that keeps all the official stats. I'm looking at the rankings of. Oh no, I'm sorry. That was. It would help if I get out of preseason here. get into regular season here. Looking at their numbers, it was 4.92. If you remember that year, I think a lot of teams did a good job of running the football that year. And for some reason, that number doesn't look right. But I guess it's
4.92.
Let me double check these stats here. But regardless, ranked league wide, that was so one of the lowest number in the bottom third of the league that year. 4.29. New Orleans 6.28. Man, these certainly don't look right. It's on the media side of things. Anyway, let's bypass this right now. Why double check some of these stats? I wouldn't think they'd be wrong on the media side of things here. But regardless, what I'm getting at here is teams have won Super Bowls in the past without stellar running games. You go back to the Giants a few years ago, and even the Green Bay Packers several years ago. But you know, I guess where I'm trying to go with this is, you know, Le'Veon Bell. And here's where I wanted to kind of make the next transition here in the conversation about Le'Veon Bell. We've talked quite a bit about average yearly value and what he in the running back market. I mean, look, the next highest paid running back is LeSean McCoy at around eight million something, right? And is Le'Veon Bell worth more than David DeCastro?
I mean, you're comparing two different positions, two different market values. I mean, that's always, I think, difficult to try to do. I mean, if you made me choose who would I rather have, David DeCastro or Le'Veon Bell, it's Le'Veon Bell, and honestly, I don't have to think very hard about it.
Yeah, and David DeCastro is new. The new money of his, you know, his latest deal averages out at $10 million. So, I mean, can you really expect a guy that touches the football and produces as much as he does? You know, I understand the market's the market, but the market's also, what a player can get as well. And right now, Le'Veon Bell can get a little over $12 million. Now, as far as the long-term deal goes, we'll find out very soon whether or not he can, break, the $10 million average value barrier. But personally, I think it'd be a bit slap in the face if you don't at least pay him a little bit more than a guy like, than David DeCastro, a guy that blocks for him and all. So, is that number 10.5? Obviously, I don't think Le'Veon Bell's, I've said all along, 12 to maybe 12.5 might be the ceiling for him. I don't think there's going to be any of that 14 or 15 million anything along those lines there. And one final note on that, I think a few people were kind of confused when I was talking those contract numbers in that last podcast. When I talk about Le'Veon Bell possibly needing to get around $18 million in that first year, I'm not saying all that's guaranteed money. Obviously, the Steelers, when you're dealing with players not named Ben Roethlisberger, the only guaranteed money the fully guaranteed money that they normally circle there is the signing bonus and the signing bonus only. So, that was the case with DeCastro and Cameron Hayward and stuff along those lines. So, when I'm talking about getting Le'Veon Bell to $18 million in 2017, his first year, construct that however you want. Do you want it to be $12 million signing bonus on a five-year deal and $6 million base salary? But, I mean, let's face the facts. He's going to see whatever base salary you give him. So even though that's not called guaranteed, barring him, doing something totally stupid, getting arrested and suspended or whatnot, and having to just be cut outright, you might as well consider that base money in 2017 guaranteed as well. And I think the biggest obstacle right now when you're talking about these two sides in negotiations is, whether or not, I'm sure his side's going to be pulling for those roster bonuses in maybe year two and year three. And, the reason the kind of those players go after that is it kind of gives them a little bit of job security and it gives them some money a little bit earlier, than they probably normally would get as well, too. So when you see some of these roster bonuses included in contracts are normally have to be paid out by the fifth day of the league year. And, that puts teams in precarious position sometimes with players that, look, we pay him this, we absolutely got to keep him from that point, you know, forward into the season. Mm-hmm. Whereas a guy like Le'Veon Bell, the Steelers might say, look, you know, the position you play, we'd kind of like to make your second year total earnings really be just your base salary, because that way we can cut your legs out from underneath you. You know, even right ahead of the regular 2018 regular season starting. So, you know, just little things like that to talk about. But, you know, I've settled along, I think, you know, $18 million in year one of the deal. And because of the possibility that franchise tag, you know, 12 point whatever million this year, $14.5 million. I mean, you're looking at $26, $27 million. He's going to probably want $28, $29 million through the first 2 years, you know, as far as that goes. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Once again, you know, we've only moved forward a few days in the calendar. I have no reason to think that a deal won't get done, but I accept the possibility that it might not get done. He might have to play underneath the tag as well, too. So anything mm-hmm. else to add about fungibility and running backs and the value of them and as far as anything like that goes?
Well, just two quick things. I think Bell has clearly shown his value, and he is more than a niche running back, and I bet 99.5% of us agree on that fact. The second thing I wanted to actually ask you, Dave, was I had a short conversation with someone on Twitter yesterday, and you know, they said that even if a deal doesn't get done, you know, they'll bring Bell back for next year. And I said, well, it's not under contract next year. You're going to have to get a deal done. And the guy said, well, you could franchise tag him again. I don't think there's any chance they would franchise tag Bell 2 years in a row where that salary bumps up even more. But what do you think? Is that even in the realm of possibility if a deal does not get done?
Man, because you would be – look, I mean, if you get him at
– It's 120% of this year's salary, right?
Well, I mean, you're talking about $14 million, you know, over $14 right. million. I think Joel Corey think it'll be around 14.5 or something around those numbers. So, I mean, that's where I get that – bargaining power right now on Bell's side is that he thinks that he can get, you know, his value to the Steelers at two back-to-back tags is over $26 million, almost $27 million. Okay. Now, people might think, well, okay, you know, pay him now or pay him later kind of thing. But you got to remember that if you the tag number is going to be $14 million as well next year, whereas if you work out a long-term deal with him now, not only will his tag number be lower than $12.12 million this year, it's going to be considerably lower than $14 million next year as well, too. So you got to keep that in mind as well. Now, obviously, the Steelers, if he performed well underneath the tag this year and had a fantastic season, the Steelers could probably manage a high number like that, because let's face it, if you get him at 14 something million, it's because he deserved that 14. He deserves to be franchise tagged. Then how hard is it going to be to work out a long term deal with him then? You know, if mm-hmm. you weren't able to do it now. So if a long term deal doesn't get worked out this year with him, I don't think they. You know, I will be surprised if they franchised him. You know, next year, I just think it's just too expensive.
Yeah, that's where I'm at too.
I'm struggling here as to why these numbers off. Looking at Pro Football Focus, it looks like they have the Steelers down for 3.7 yards per carry. I was looking at per mm-hmm. play. I'm looking at the wrong damn column here. I was looking at okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense now. But regardless, I mean, they weren't a great team rushing the football in 2008. Just goes to show you that some teams can get away with that. You know, you don't mm-hmm. necessarily need to have the star running back or the main guy there in order to get the job done. All right, I spent way much more time than I wanted to on that topic there, but a lot of good things discussed there. Which way do we want to move forward, or what way did we say we wanted to move forward from here?
You wanted to talk about some of the receivers, right? I have more receivers focused podcast today.
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, I want to start it off with going back to last year and what would have happened, Alex, had Marcus Wheaton entered or exited the preseason fully healthy, and Martavis Bryant had not been suspended.
Oh man, that is a heavy question to start my day off with. Well, my first thought is, you know, for Bryant, you know, the long term effects on the team that he could be, you know, you'd have a high chance of him being around in the long term. Now it's, I think, flip a coin because of obviously his off the field issues. But, you know, to the short term in the last year, to have that number two receiver in Bryant, and you don't have all the revolving door with Coates and Hamilton and guys like that, would have given the offense some much needed stability and consistency, which, you know, would have put them on a different level and obviously made them more competitive in, say, a game against New England.
When you look at when you look back on going into last season there, what would happen to a guy like Eli Rogers?
Yeah, he would have been squeezed. You know, maybe he would have chipped away a little bit of time. It's hard to say for sure, but, you know, he had some work ethic issues. Remember him showing up late for walkthroughs that got him benched for one game. What was it, New England, or I forget which game it was. And Wheaton would have put in the work. So, you know, if the team would have lost Wheaton in the offseason, like what actually ended up happening, then you'd be going into this year with a very much unknown at your slot with, you know, presumably still Juju Smith-Schuster and Eli Rogers. So, yeah, I guess the one good thing for the Wheaton injury was you found a lot out about Eli Rogers and have some more information to work off of.
Yeah, I mean, if Marcus, are you, you know, I'm less about Martavis Bryant, more about Marcus Wheaton here. If he would have been healthy here, we're talking about Wheaton last season, do you think we really wouldn't have seen much of any out of Eli Rogers?
Yeah, but it would have been limited work for sure.
Yeah, you know, you look back at what Eli did, you know, and the way things played out with it, and of course you look back before that in his college career, and of course his rookie season wiped out by a foot injury, and we kind of knew going in though that they had a guy that could be a good route runner there, and at points last season he did show that he's a very good route runner. You know, that seam pass against who, the Bengals, that I think probably, in my opinion, that's kind of his highlight play right now, right?
Yeah, and the Baltimore game too at the end of the final drive, that big catch he had.
Right, you know, those are his signature kind of plays right now. I wanted to kind of focus on him because I went back last night and clearing out some video files and came across some of the study stuff that I had on Juju Smith-Schuster, and wow. Yeah, I mean, why didn't we see this coming with him? You know, we kind of knew going into the draft that, okay, maybe a guy like Chris Godwin, were we too focused on the fact of, okay, well, the Steelers could draft a wide receiver, but we're only going to focus on guys they seem to be interested on, as opposed to open our minds up, because let's face it, if we would have thoroughly studied Juju Smith, which I just did, you know, surface kind of highlight view stuff on Juju prior to the draft, because I just didn't really view him as an option. If we had sat down and thoroughly evaluated Juju, would we have been banging the table for him in round two?
More than I think what we did, which was very little, but you know, it's tough. You can't get to everybody. And he didn't necessarily profile as the height, weight, speed kind of guy that Steelers normally go after. You know, he's bigger, but he's not, you know, Coates or Bryant in terms of, you know, being able to run 4.4. So I don't know if we would have ever gotten to that point, especially with the lack of communication and the lack of evidence they were interested in Smith-Schuster. And Juju admitted it himself. I think he said he talked to him at the combine for the 15-minute interview, and that was the only time he talked to him, which is probably pretty rare for what the Steelers do early on in the draft. So, you know, I think it took us all by surprise. But when you look back on it, sure, and I think you do that with any pick, you look back on it and go, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's the kind of thing that you – there's the whole time – you know, how much time do we have to view X amount of players, you know, versus need versus you just too many variables there, and we don't have a we don't have a East Coast West Coast scouting team and at Steelers Depot. You know,
you're the West Coast scouting team.
Yeah,
Dave.
Absolutely. I'm faltering on my job then when it comes to the case of Juju. No, I just think, you know, going back and kind of watching some of the stuff that I have on him again, you know, a few months removed from the draft. It really gets you excited about him, and you know, you've written extensively about, you know, how, you know, potential use in the slot, because where else is he going to play, to be quite honest with you? You know, especially if you have Martavis Bryant back, and you look about, you know, you look at the possibility of him maybe possibly rotating with Eli Rogers early in the season and those kind of things. Really is easy to get excited over a player like Juju. So I guess now is you wanted to kind of use this episode as kind of a springboard into getting into positional breakdowns ahead of training camp. So we're already talking about a lot of these wide receivers here. So, you know, why don't we kind of stay on track here? And, you know, what's there? You know, we'll start with the top of the food chain here in Antonio Brown. And I broke down Antonio Brown since I think we last talked. Was he in that first group of four or in that second group of four? I don't really remember there, but not much needs to be said or done with Antonio Brown. I think the biggest thing that sticks out about him last season is how his yak average, you know, kind of fell a little bit. Now, was that the result of him just seeing so much attention, you know, week in or week out or what? You know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's obvious that he did receive more attention, and it's a lot easier to get a guy on the ground after the catch when you have, you know, a lot more people in proximity of him there. But, you know, is that really the only kind of knock on Antonio Brown right now, is the fact that I'd like to see his yak get back to where it was?
Yeah, and I don't even know if I'd call it a knock, because I think it can be explained by the reasons that you said, being double teamed a lot. I think maybe they took an M. I'm guessing here, but I think they took some more vertical shots with him last year because they didn't have, you know, Coates, and they didn't have Bryant to be that vertical threat. So that limits yak anytime that you're going with a more vertical approach, and just some bad luck as well. Some defenders making good plays. I remember Tavon Young having a spectacular tackle on Brown in the open field, you know, in Baltimore, and I think the first matchup. So stuff like that, you know, things Brown has to get better at. It's obviously limited. Just consistent effort as a blocker and any sort of sudden change, turnover situations. There were times where he got a little lazy, and, you know, and just to not be that guy that feels like he needs to have the ball every single play. You can tell he has to kind of control his emotions a little bit better and keep things in check and not feel like he has to get the ball every single play. But, you know, receivers are going to be receivers. But, you know, obviously, AB, for my money, still the best receiver in the league, and his ability to separate and stem in his route and all the nuances he has makes him the best receiver, because even though he's undersized and he's not the fastest guy, the best receiver is an open one, and no one gets open like Antonio Brown.
Finally got these damn stats sorted right. 3 point back to 2008 we go. 3.67 yards per carry for the Steelers in 2008. Fourth worst in the league. But hey, the team they beat in the Super Bowl that year, Arizona, 3.46. They had an even worse yards per carry. So there you go. The two teams that played in the Super Bowl that year, the Steelers and Arizona, ranked near the bottom of the league in rushing yards per play. So, more studies need to be done on that, maybe. But back to wide receivers here. Look, with Antonio Brown, I'd like to see him be a little bit more helpful in the blocking department, but with what he does in the other areas of the game, I would feel very, very bad if he suffered a serious injury while, you know, downfield trying to block or something like that. The other kind of thing with him, obviously the celebrations and the kind of the foolish penalties. Hopefully that'll change with this. You know, hopefully there won't be any of those in 2017 with this rule change. Moving on, Martavis Bryant. You know, we obviously haven't seen him in over a year. What a tremendous deep threat he is. I'd like to see a little less one-trick pony with him. You know, I'd like to see him be a more consistent and more contributions from him kind of in the 8 to 12 yard range, if you will. We all know he can get deep and beat people with one of the best in the league when it comes to deep threats. But I'd like to see him do a little bit more outside of that.
Sure, I think that's natural for any younger or less experienced receiver. But I think Brian is capable of that, and I believe the weight and strength that he's going to add this year by getting up to about 230 pounds is going to help him with some of those contested catches and going over the middle. But yeah, super excited, obviously, for Martavis Bryant like the rest of the league. Do remember he's still conditionally reinstated. The league will have to fully reinstate him before week one. So just to keep that in mind, not that we expect there to be an issue, but just want to keep that in the back of everyone's mind. But he's going to be the starting Z receiver this year to the right side of the formation, and should be a big year for him. Certainly needed.
All right, Eli Rogers, above average out route runner, in my opinion. I think sometimes I like to see him use his body a little bit better, kind of shielding catches, and of course be a little bit more combative catcher, which is kind of hard to do at his size, obviously. What are kind of strengths and weaknesses with him?
He can run good routes. He's made difficult catches. I think obviously he showed a good deal of improvement as the year went along. I think as a guy that built up a rapport with Ben throughout the season. I went back and I was actually watching the Washington game week one last year, and the first interception that Ben threw came off miscommunication, I think, with Eli Rogers. So just got to continue to show that work ethic, because we've seen some issues with that, and that's going to be a big difference because his wide receiver room is super crowded.
Do you consider him right now a better slot player than Marcus Wheaton was?
I have a train going by, so my 11:30 to Philadelphia is rolling through right now. But I don't know. That's tough to evaluate. Wheaton was just – he never got healthy enough to get those reps. He got better, Wheaton did, as a yak threat, which was the big bugaboo with him. I think they're pretty comparable right now. I'd have to probably really kind of comb through it, but I think they're sort of on the same level. Rogers isn't as explosive, isn't as dynamic, isn't the vertical threat that Wheaton was. Remember, Wheaton ran like 4.44 coming out of Oregon State. But I think in terms of the slot and getting open in their hands, I'd give a slight edge to Wheaton, but I think they're on a similar plane, and then Rogers will continue to get better.
Obviously, the quarterback situation with the Bears is a little less than ideal. But are we going to have another Emmanuel Sanders in Marcus Wheaton? In other words, the guy really turn into the guy that we thought he could be the moment he leaves Pittsburgh?
I think it could happen. I think Chicago got a really good value with a 2-year, $6 million deal. I think there's nowhere to go but up for Wheaton, and if he stays healthy, and I get that's the if, he's a really good player when he's healthy, and if he can ever get consistent reps both in game and in practice, I think he'll take his game to a different level.
Sort of reminds you a little bit of those. Especially the talk about Sanders, yeah, entering the Steelers and then exiting the Steelers. It was like, oh, this guy's a good route runner, but him and Ben just never could get on the same page. Mm-hmm. Maybe is it because both guys are maybe so disciplined? I don't know what it was, but Emmanuel Sanders just never seemed to be able to get on the same page as Roethlisberger. And really, you heard Roethlisberger talk about Wheaton kind of the same way. Couldn't get on, mm-hmm. The two couldn't get on the same page. So yeah, I think we could see maybe Wheaton have a career year, if you will, assuming he sticks and all, which he should with the Bears. Obviously, be interesting to watch what happens with the quarterback situation there. But this is not Bears Depot right now. So moving on, which one do you want to talk about next? Darius Heyward Bey, the buck's been out on him for a while. You go deep, and we hope you catch it, kind of wide receiver. Talk about it time and time again. He's been able to hang around the league because of the fact of him making the decision that he played special teams a couple years ago, late in the season with the Indianapolis Colts. He turned out to be pretty decent at it. This guy is who he is right now, though.
You're right. He's not going to get any better, but I'm really happy to have a guy like Darius Heyward Bey. I think every receiver locker room needs a guy like him, a steady no diva, totally calm leader, that locker room. And I honestly think that Darius Hayward Bay is the leader of any receiver in that locker room. You know, I think, you know, I've said it many times, but AB is the guy everyone looks to and they watch him work and they want to emulate that. But when you want to go break down film or you have a question, most people go to Darius Hayward Bay. He's the vet. He's the guy that's been through the highs and lows of it all, and I think that's really valuable. And that's one reason why I think it's going to be really tough, and I'd be fairly surprised to see him cut because of what he offers as a special teamer, his ability to play anywhere, play all three spots, and do it at a high level with confidence and trust from the coaching staff to do so, what he brings as a leader, again, as that steady presence to help the young guys out. I think it's really invaluable, so I expect him to stay.
I've talked so long about him and the justifications of him being around. In fact, if you go back to the original kind of post that I wrote after he was signed a couple years ago, I said, look, this guy really has value as a special teams guy. I've admitted all along he's not much of a wide receiver, you know, outside of a deep threat. And I think I preached that so long about how he's been able to be a solid special teams contributor, that I found myself now trying not to cut him, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've thought about this the other night when I was laying in bed staring at the ceiling. Something I do a lot of is I think it's time to take a step back and think just how good a special teamer he is versus maybe how a guy like Sammy Coates can be, on top of when you start getting into the numbers crunching situation, man, it's going to be tough. You know, you've even at times had him keeping seven. It obviously can be a number anywhere between five and seven that's kept this year. I think when it comes down to it, it's going to be very, very tough for Darius Hayward Bay, and he's going to have to be more Arnez Battle than he is Justin Hunter, if you will.
Yeah, it's a good name for you. I like it, Arnez Battle.
You know, when it comes to wide receivers. So, obviously, any injuries ahead of Darius Hayward Bay on the depth chart help him tremendously. But it's one of those things right now. I think you got to roll the dice on him. I mean, I surely wouldn't bet my house, and I hope you wouldn't bet mine either on him making the final 53.
I wouldn't bet your house, Dave. I'm a nice guy, but I'll say this. I think it would be a mistake to cut Darius Hayward Bay, and I get it's a tough decision. It's going to be tough to cut whoever they end up releasing. I expect this whole room to play really, really well, but I think it would be a mistake to cut him.
Sammy Coates, boy, what a great start he had last year, and it really you're coming in really into that game against the Jets thinking, okay, you know, this team not having Martin Tavis Bryant, and okay, they laid a stinker there, you know, in the game against Philadelphia, but hey, you know, this team's going to be all right receiver wise. Well, he had another decent game against the Jets, but he suffered that hand finger injury as well too, and from that point forward, he wasn't the same receiver. What, two catches, 14 yards? They tried to play him and work him through it. The drops happened. The kind of the lack of focus, I think, happened. He wasn't battling, trying to battle for some of those 50-50 or underthrown balls by Ben Roethlisberger. And boy, by the end of the year, he was the new Darius Hayward Bay. He was the guy. He was the guy playing on special teams. And even though he played better than I think a lot of people expected him to play on special teams, you know, this is a former third round draft pick that you're talking about here. And you know, even coming out of the first quarter of the season there, a guy that you still said this might be a one-trick pony as well, too. You go back to what Kevin Colbert said prior to the 2017 or 16 season, talking about needing Sammy Coates to become a better route runner. We haven't seen that yet. So we're talking about just a younger version of Darius Hayward Bay here, or what?
Well, I honestly think you started to see some, you know, well-roundedness in his game right before he got hurt. The Kansas City game, I think maybe the Jets game as well. You know, you've seen some evidence of that, him working well in scramble drills, him doing some stuff over the middle that wasn't just a go-deep kind of guy. It just got cut real quick because of the injury. And, you know, last year, by the end of the year, like you alluded to, he was a shell of himself mentally. It weighed down on him. He's talked about it, how tough it was to try to get through that and to want to be out there to help and to not be able to. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like if the first month of the year where you're really playing well and you feel like everything's clicking and you think this is going to be your year and the start of kind of your whole new career, and then it all goes down the tubes in an instant. So that has to be incredibly tough to deal with. You know, I don't want to personally talk about Coach too much because I've talked about him so much. I mean, Dave, feel free to jump in with any of your thoughts, but, you know, I just want fans to remember the first 4 and 5 weeks of the year when Sammy Coates was leading the league in yards per catch and not necessarily what happened after the fact, because that can be directly tied into the injury, which, you know, people have to realize is that he wasn't dropping it because he wasn't, you know, he just has bad hands. He was dropping it because his hands were broken. It's like Antoine Blake 2 years ago. I mean, he was playing poorly because he was playing with one arm out there, and that's going to be tough to succeed in.
Do you remember who Steve Sachs was?
I don't.
He was a former baseball player, second baseman for years, and he just got to a situation where he couldn't throw the ball to first. I mean, he just go all over the place, and really? And now it's called, you know, kind of,
the yips. Was that like the
yeah,
yips?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you call it the Steve Sachs syndrome or whatever. And before that, I think you kind of had the Steve Blast disease. Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of things there. You know, it's easy to talk about. Well, he just needs to get over this mental aspect of it. And he's talked about the mental aspect of it as well. But some players just have a problem about flipping that switch, mm-hmm. you know, back to where it needs to be. Any concern whatsoever that he's going to be able to, you know, get back the confidence or whatever, you know, that he needs to be the player that he was at least through the first quarter of last season?
Yeah, I think it was always a concern coming off injury. How does the guy respond, and does he get the trust back in his hands and in himself? And not only just coming into camp, but what happens after that first drop? Because it's going to happen. You're a receiver, you're going to drop passes. It's natural. How does he respond and deal with that? So that's kind of what I'm curious to see him with, because you're right, that is a concern. I remember Steve Blash, you know, obviously calls Pirates games. They talk about that quite a bit. I think it was a Troy Tulowitzki, I think, a couple of years ago had that problem as well. So, you know, the game of football, we talk about it all the time, 90% mental. We use that cliche a lot, but then we forget about it when it's time to apply it. And it was certainly applicable last year for Sammy Coates.
Okay, Justin Hunter, the new addition during the offseason. You know, odds tell you that the timing of when he was signed, going back to the history of Kevin Colbert, bodes well for him. But, boy, this is a crowded wide receiver room. I've said it time and time again when it comes to Justin Hunter, the fact that he's going to have to prove real, real quick to Danny Smith that he can help on special teams. And I personally, I don't think he's that kind of guy, even though he's 6'4", 203. You'd think this guy would be able to follow suit with what Darius Hayward Bay did. This guy has also kind of had the knock on him as being you go deep and that's it kind of player. I like him. I like the signing, especially for the price. I like any signing when it's minimum when it's minimum cut, because really, what do you have to lose? You know, if you don't have, if you have very limited guaranteed money involved, people say, well, do you like this signing? Do you not like this signing? I like every signing when it's minimum value, because it gives you a long time to look at the player, you know, everything. So yeah, I absolutely love the signing of Justin Hunter. But the question becomes is he talented enough, and is there a spot for him, you know, with his team?
Those are the two big questions, you know, the talent and the spot. I think the answer to the first question is yes, he has lots of talent. And I think playing with Ben, the best quarterback he's ever been with, is gonna help that. And I do believe Justin Hunter is gonna have a really strong training camp in preseason, because, you know, he's a guy that's gonna look good in shorts, you know, when he's 6'4" and runs well and can leap, you know, out of the gym. And when you go into preseason, when you're playing against backup rookie cornerbacks and young guys that don't have the experience he does, I mean, Hunter is gonna look good. He's gonna make plays, and I bet you once we get close to cut down, you're going to have a big group of Steelers Nation saying you have to keep Justin Hunter. But the second part of your question is the all-important one, the spot. And I just think the fit's going to be really tough right now, because you have so many Z receiver types on this roster with Martavis Bryant, Sammy Coates, Darius Hayward-Bay can do that as well. And while Hunter can actually play in the slot and did a decent amount of that in Buffalo last year, it's not really going to be ideal for him, and that's a pretty crowded position as well. So I just think finding a home for him is going to be tough. I believe his best path is Sammy Coates to to fall apart, and that might put Hunter in a position to take his spot.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be tough for him. He's going to be fun to watch during training camp and the preseason. Needs to stay healthy, too, on top of it, because, I mean, you're not going to win a spot if you can't practice and play in all those games. Bless his heart, Kobe Hamilton. If there's an effort guy, a guy that you say, man, if you would have told me he would have had to play the amount of snaps that he played last season when he was originally signed and on, I would have thought, oh, man, no way the Steelers are going to have end up in the AFC Championship game. But Kobe Hamilton played a lot of snaps last season. And the knock on him, obviously, it just doesn't have the long speed. He didn't make a lot of, Kobe Hamilton will forever be known in Pittsburgh by Steelers fans as a guy that can make some third down catches, because that's pretty much all he has done. Outside of that, man, this guy really, with all these new faces and people returning and all like that, it's just not going to be in the cards for Kobe Hamilton.
Agreed. But I believe he still has practice squad eligibility. I think Matthew Marksey was talking about that. Do you know, Dave, off the top of your head? I think he's eligible.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to go back and look at kind of these rule changes now. They're making it now where they want to see as many of these second-year guys at least be able to hang on, with practice squad. So I'll have to go back and look at games played versus year and all like that. So he might very well have some eligibility left there. People are going to get on us if we don't talk about DeMarcus Ayers. And the thing about DeMarcus Ayers is, man, what really do we know about him right now?
Well, I think we got a decent, some sort of sample size last year that he can play on the outside. He can play in the slot. He's done well to beat man coverage. I think he's going to make a push for Antonio Brown's punt return spot, because although I'd still keep AB as the punt returner, as I've said many times before, and as I'm sure Steeler fans have witnessed, the team has looked every avenue possible to try to get AB off punt returns, and Ayers is going to be the leader if anyone's able to supplant him. So that's going to be maybe his ticket to getting onto the roster, is being that slot backup, slot guy, and starting punt returner. But he's a hard worker. And there's no doubt about that. He's fully healthy. He wasn't fully healthy in camp last year, and he's going to work his tail off. And that's why I think he could really push Eli Rogers.
Kanan Severin, Kobe Hamilton light?
Well, that's a guy I really don't know much about, because he got hurt, a couple practices in, and he's healthy now and able to come back. He's a bigger body, but maybe a little CJ Goodwin-ish, a little lesser athlete of CJ Goodwin.
Yeah, we're going to see a lot of him probably during the early preseason games late in the fourth quarter, along with a guy like Josh Dobbs. So him and Marcus Tucker maybe as well, too. Tucker more of an X guy, I think, right? X position guy.
Yeah, I'm trying to think where they played him last year. I think he actually was on the outside more, which I was a little surprised, because I picked him in the slot, and maybe I guess I was wrong in that assessment. But I know Tucker's been working out really hard this offseason. I've been following him on social media, and he posts like almost every day. So he's working really hard. Obviously, he's practice squad at best in such a crowded room. It's going to be tough to even do that. But, I'll always root for those smaller school guys.
Seems like every year, or at least the last couple of years, we're thinking, man, you look at this wide receiver group. Just think how great they can be. We could have 3 1,000-yard receivers, and is there a chance we have at least 2,000-yard receivers this year? Or is that pushing it?
It's obviously pushing it. It's not impossible. I'd have to do the math on Martavis Bryant, because obviously he'd be the other guy to get 1,000 along AB. Is Bryant going to get enough catches? Is the volume there enough to do so? I mean, I think Bryant can get between 55 and 65 receptions this year. I'd have to do the math to see what that works out to yards-wise. So not impossible, but unlikely, just because there are so many weapons, and you're going to run the ball with Le'Veon Bell, and he's going to catch 75 or 80 passes that – no other guy is going to get the volume needed to get over that 1,000-yard mark.
Boy, if they go into this season with let's say Antonio Brown, Martavis Bryant, Juju, Eli Rogers, Sammy Coates, and draw the line even there, boy, that's a heck of a group.
Yeah, on paper, it should be not only one of the best in terms of talent at the top, but one of the deepest wide receiver groups in the NFL.
So, anything to add about this group? I mean, we shouldn't have to talk about this group again until the preseason starts, right?
Right. Yeah, it's going to be a great group to watch at training camp in Latrobe. They're going to be one of the most competitive, intense groups. And to every Steelers cornerback, watch out, get ready, because you're not going to have a day off.
Are you ready to take some questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did we not hit on anything that I said I think I wanted to hit on? I think we got everything, right?
Yep.
All right. We reached out to the listeners on Thursday night, and here is what they want to know. This one from Jeremy Babati at Jericho4854, I think, on Twitter. I should wear my glasses more. Shame on me. If this is Ben's last year, might the team take a run at Kirk Cousins?
No, I think if they're going to do it, anything, they're going to build it in-house their way, the way that they found Ben, the way that they found Bradshaw, that they're going to draft and go internally, finding a quarterback instead of playing the crazy free agent game of quarterbacks on the market.
You know, I've always been kind of a silent fan of Kirk Cousins.
You have? Oh, day.
I really, this is the end. I really have. Back to his college days and all. And wasn't he one of the guys that Tomlin went and met with, had the pre-draft dinner with? And I really thought there was a decent chance that year that, they might take him at some point, that obviously didn't happen, but, this is a guy that obviously Kirk Cousins has his flaws, but he can throw the deep ball, right?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched this game too closely. I mean, he's an above-average quarterback. I just don't see him as a quarterback that can ever take it to a Super Bowl, and I'm not interested in guys that can't do that for this franchise, and especially his price tag is going to be just out of the question for me.
Yeah, the short answer to Jeremy is no. That would be mine as well, too. But I just had to get out there that he's kind of a guy that's always kind of intrigued me. And I think he's a guy that can take the if they surround him with the right players, I think he can make a push in the playoffs as well. I think he might still be a little underrated after all he's done. I'll just kind of leave it at that. From Greg at Greg the Great 21 on Twitter. What position could the Steelers still add a veteran at before week one? Tight end or inside linebacker?
I think both are possible. I think inside linebacker is more likely than tight end because I think they do like Xavier Grimble, and I think keeping three tight ends is going to suit them fine. Don't forget about nose tackle, with McCullers' roster spot looking very much up in the air right now. I know they've worked guys like LT Walton at the nose, and maybe they do Tyson Alualu as well, but, those guys are still more defensive ends, and they could bring on a nose tackle. So I think those are the spots I would look at the closest, Greg.
I would agree, and I think Greg identified tight end and inside linebacker correctly. You, of course, with nose tackle. I'm still holding out hope for Steve McClendon to find his way back to Pittsburgh for one final last hurrah there. We'll see if that happens. It doesn't look like it at this point. You would think the Jets would have cut bait with him maybe by now, especially when they purged all those guys, David Harris and who's the other
Decker.
Yeah. They cut ties with there as well too. So look, I mean, not many tight ends out there at this point. Really, the only inside linebacker out there right now is Zach Orr, in my opinion there. So good question nonetheless there. Let's see. You looking at some of these?
I didn't even know we were doing questions today. So is it on? Did you have a tweet about it or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, I did. Probably you were in front of the TV watching a Pirates game or something. Ben's rating with a receiver 6'3 or taller on the field versus not are amazing. This is from Deion Johnson. When Martavis back this year, we should see if the numbers are true. Thoughts on this? That's interesting. He's saying Ben's quarterback rating with a receiver 6'3 or taller on the field versus not are amazing. Are we using combine heights? Are we using listed heights?
I've never seen numbers on that. Have you, Dave?
No, I haven't looked into that. Ben all along saying he likes the big wide receivers, right? I would have to look into this, and I'm not sure I'm going to have the time to do it. I suppose I could take some of my sortable charts and then run through and add some heights into it. Well, we have the charting, right? You know, from the last 3 years. So, Dion, if you want to give us a little bit better idea, you know, where those stats have come from, send me a link or DM me a link or email me a link. You know, give us a starting point there. Alex and I are kind of flying blind into that one.
Yeah. So, I would say this though. Is that generally speaking, when the Steelers have had tall receivers on the field, they've had talented receivers on the field. You know, Martavis Bryant, of course, is going to make Ben better because he's a talented receiver, partially because he's 6'3", 6'4", but also just because he's really good. So I think, you know, there's that to be considered as well.
Yeah, and going back to Plaxico, right, as well. So help me out, Dion. Send me some info on that or a starting point there. Allie Mahalik, that's a creative name. At Ali Mahalik, what is going on with the contract situation in Bell? your guess is as good as mine, Ali. I do not know. I mean, I don't think we're going to know really. There's probably going to be a few posturing statements by an agent here, you know, over the course of next week, saying we don't think a deal's going to get done, and you know, that kind of stuff that goes along with that. But none of us really know what's going on with the contract situation outside of a week from Monday is the deadline. So, you know, we're just sitting here waiting and speculating as much as the next guy there. Let's see. Bobby Price at Gray Feb 23. Steelers have led league in 2-point attempts past two seasons. You guys think the over-under of 10 attempts in 2017 and over-under 55% conversion rate? Basically, he's saying, do we think they'll have more than 10 attempts, 2-point conversion attempts in 2017, and will the conversion rate be 55% or more?
I think they will have more than 10 attempts this year. I think getting the band back together on offense, I think if Jesse James and whatever happens in the slot, you know, continues to improve the red zone defense, that it'll instill more confidence in this team to be aggressive for 2-point conversions. A lot of it could come down to what happens in training camp. You know, they start 7 shots every single practice in training camp, and if they look good, then obviously very 2-point conversion situations, then that might have Tomlin be more aggressive in those situations. So I think that they will, because Jesse James is getting work there. If Juju Smith-Schuster can make an impact in the red zone, obviously having Martavis Bryant back, you had yourself a lot of red zone, you know, short yardage weapons, and I think that's going to be the catalyst to getting this team to have more attempts. Conversion rate, I mean, it's a crapshoot. Who knows if they're successful or not. Ideally, though, if you're attempting it that many times, it's because it's working, and so your conversion rate is going to be higher than 55.
You know Tomlin's going to go for it for two more than 10, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his gut tells him.
Right, I'll take the over on both those, Bobby. Christian Perry writes, what happened to Ricardo Matthews? You think McClendon could make a return? Look, realistically, with McClendon, I don't think it's going to happen. It's just one of those things that, you know, I'd like to see one more year. I think he's a better player still today than Daniel McCullers. I think he provides some nice experience depth there on a defensive line. But realistically, I think that ship has sailed. Ricardo Matthews, you want to talk about a guy that just disappeared into thin air real quick? That's the guy. You know, obviously not great last year with the Steelers. Probably played a lot more snaps than they originally envisioned him having to play. But I think he was a better player than Cam Thomas was a few years ago.
Well, that's a low bar to set. that's the curse of this backup Steelers defense alignment. We always say they played more than we thought that they had to. And Matthews got dinged pretty good last year with an ankle injury. He tried to dog himself through the last 4 weeks of the season in the playoffs. And honestly, though, I thought even when healthy, he didn't play well. And I'm happy that they moved on.
All right, from Randall Butzbaum, keys to improving the red zone efficiency. Boy, where do we start there? I tell you, the starting point is don't get inside the 5.
Yeah, offensive coordinator Brian, that advice.
I've always thought that Ben kind of functions better with the more field, you know, that he has to work with. And I think it's probably true with a lot of quarterbacks, maybe not named Tom Brady, but you know, I'd like to see them run a lot, you know, a few more of those cover three. You know, when they go against such defenses inside the red zone, there, a few more of those seam beaters. You know, and Roethlisberger kind of put the ball exactly where it needs to go instead of him waiting for a guy to be kind of college open, if you will. You know, I think that this team is able to convert a little bit better when they're in the red zone, but not inside the 10, and definitely not inside the 5.
Yeah, I'd have to look at the numbers real close. I think I was asked about this the other day, and I can't remember my answer entirely. I look at it on a couple different levels, though. One is eliminate penalties. I remember there were at least several drives last year where there were red zone penalties, which anytime you have that, you back yourself up and you put yourself in a hole. So that's one very obvious thing that has to get worked upon. You know, I would go in a different direction with kind of the schematics. Instead of beating, you know, zone coverage, cover three, I think that's tough to do down the seam in some short yard situations, but some more man coverage beaters, like the mesh concept that they were running pretty heavily, I think, starting in the Baltimore game in week 16 last year, and did it against Cleveland as well. Because even if a team doesn't play man coverage, when you're in, you know, red zone, goal to go situations, everything kind of functions as man coverage because everything's in there so tight. So I think some more man coverage concepts, beaters, and some of those combination routes, like a mesh where you're having two crossers, the Y coming over the top of a slot receiver to kind of set a pick that will open somebody up. So I'd like to see that. To go back to some Haley staples that have worked in the red zone, the spot concept before, which is a curl flat corner triangle read, which has been really effective in the past. And I think, again, just getting the personnel back is going to be the key as well. When you add Juju Smith-Schuster, Jesse James, if he's able to take another step, which I hope and expect him to, will be big. And then, obviously, adding Martavis Bryant as a potential red zone threat is speaks for itself. So I think adding the personnel and changing the schematics, I think, will help the efficiency.
I'd like to see him use the tight end in there a little bit more as well, too. I think Jesse James has really shown that he can be. I mean, look, you want a big guy in there, and I think if you get a little creative in there with some play action, like we've seen in the past as well, too, I think there should be a staple in there where maybe James is your first read, you know, because he's so big and he's done a good job so far, in my opinion, of being a reliable red zone target with him as well, too. So, boy, we could talk probably 30 more minutes about red zone, improving red zone efficiency there. All right, this one from Steel Nation Mex, obviously in Mexico. Well, I oftentimes wonder what people in Mexico think about my level of education and my dialect, my southern dialect. I wonder if they think all Americans are like that. maybe they think you're just one of these brilliant guys, you know, with the way you carry yourself there.
I hope they don't. They're wrong. I promise you.
But we've got a tremendous following, not only on the podcast, but on the site as well, from our Mexican-based fans, our Mexico-based fans. So we certainly do appreciate that. His question is, if you had to pinpoint, who is the weakest link on our defense, on our defensive chain?
Does he want individual player, or is it a group?
Do both. He doesn't specify. Oh, man.
I mean, I've said Artie Burns is the weakest starter on this team right now just because he's been so high and low. I mean, you expect him to improve and get better, and I think he will, but he was so masked by playing so much cover two last year just because it's a simple concept for any rookie corner to learn that, you know, it limited the defense. And I think it's one reason why they played so much straight cover two, why they spot drop so often. So maybe as an individual player, I'd look to him. As a group, though, you know, I've been high on the prospects of Bud Dupree and TJ Watt, but they still have to prove it. So that's the one area that I'm circling. I did it last year. I'm going to do it again this year, is that four-man rush, and primarily the outside linebackers is, you know, there's no guarantee that Bud Dupree's going to get to 12 sacks, and I think he will. He's got to prove it, and TJ Watt has to play pretty well as well. So that's the group I circle, that they make or break this defense, and by extension, they make or break this team.
Yeah, look, I've talked all along. You know, I'm not outside of Ryan Shazier right now.
I kind of worry about that that inside linebacker group. Obviously, inexperienced still, you know, and some look. Ross Cockrell's not long for this for Pittsburgh. I mean, let's be honest here.
You don't think?
I think this is it for him this year.
Right? Really?
Yeah, I really do. I think he goes somewhere else after this year. And I like Ross as well too, but I just think they you know they know some of his limitations there, and I think you know the, I don't think they're going to sign him to a long-term deal. Between now and start of the regular season, maybe they will. I mean, if you get him at a good price, why wouldn't you? I mean, it gives you some good depth there. Personally, I just don't see that's going to happen. William Gay, obviously another year older. This could be it for him as well. Cinquez Golson, we still don't know what we have there. So, you know, I think you even though I feel better than I did maybe this time last year about the Steelers cornerback group, you know, we got to see it on the field there. So maybe flip a coin between inside linebacker and cornerbacks right now.
Dave, you can't bring up this Cockrell talk so late in the podcast. I need to debate you, but we'll have to save it for next time.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I mean, we're running out of time here.
Yeah, we're out of time.
We'll talk about this in a future show. One final question I think we had here was that I saw was shot at Orr. I forget who asked it here. Trying to find it. I can't find it quick enough. Somebody asked what are the legitimate shots at Orr. Look, it'd be fun to see in my eyes, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't either.
All right, with that said, what position group are we going to tear up next time? You want to go quarterbacks or running backs or tight ends?
We could probably do quarterback, start working our way down, but we have to do the battle royale of Ross Cockrell because I got a lot to say. Bring it on.
Sounds good. You lost your last battle royale with Antoine Blake with me.
No, never. It just temporarily lost. Ran out of time. Didn't lose it.
All right. Folks, you can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. You can follow David Todd on Twitter at David M. Todd. Follow Alex Cazora at Alex_Cazora. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to donate to the cause, if you think it's a worthy cause, go to SteelersDepot.com. Find that donate button up right now. Navigational bar. We always go into these things saying we're not going to run long, but here we are. We ran long. As always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave and today, Alex Cazora.